In the early 1970s, John Hildebrand and his wife came north and built a cabin at Panguinney Creek, a tributary of the Yukon River just north of Healy. Hildebrand, first a student, then an instructor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks in the winters, spent 4 summers living off the land there. With the death of a child and the breakup of his marriage, he abandoned his dream of making a life in the wilderness. But in 1983, Hildebrand returned to the Yukon. Traveling alone in a 15-foot canoe, he embarked on a 3-month journey that carried him 2,000 miles from Whitehorse down the Yukon to within a relative stone's throw of the Bering Sea. His book, Reading the River, A Voyage Down the Yukon, is a chronicle and is an inner journey as well as a physical one, a journey through the historical context of the Yukon and of its current lives. I'm Susan McInnes for KUAC-FM, and for the next hour, you're invited to listen in to a phone conversation with author John Hildebrand. He's speaking to us from his home in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. We hope you'll put up with the bit of sea noise that's in the back. It's a satellite or perhaps phone lines winking in the breeze. John Hildebrand, good morning and welcome.
Well, good morning.
Thank you for joining us today.
It's nice to be here. I kind of like that notion of sea noise. That sounds so much nicer than static.
Good. We'll stick with sea noise and hope our listeners enjoy it as well. John, you came to Alaska at a time, it seems, when there was something of a migration or an immigration of people of a certain age. I've always wondered whether the people who were in their early to late 20s weren't leaving an America they felt somewhat disillusioned by and trying to find a new one. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I've wondered about that. I mean, I certainly didn't think about it as a social movement at the time. I mean, I just assumed that this was kind of a natural thing to do. But in retrospect, I think I do recognize it as something that was peculiar to a generation. And to tell you the truth, I don't know how much disillusionment was there. In a sense, I see a lot more innocence. I mean, it seems to me that talking with students now, because I'm still a teacher, in some ways they're a lot more, I don't know, the nice way would be, say, level-headed, maybe the bad way would be cynical, than we were. I mean, it seemed to me that we thought that there was an infinite realm of possibility that when you got out of school, what you wanted to do was to travel and see things and experience things. For many, many students now, kids in their early 20s, it's the bottom line. It's a job and right away. And I think that's a shame. I mean, I'm glad to have had it the other way.
Yeah, I think the disillusionment I was talking of, I don't think it's in opposition to what you're saying, but maybe it's a counterpoint along the way that we had come up in a time of relative innocence after the Second World War. And then as we were moving into our teen years and late teen years, there was the civil rights movement. There was a number of deaths of people we had revered. There was a war which was dreadfully painful no matter which side you stood on. And I think, perhaps to move into what you were thinking about, many of us came to Alaska perhaps to recapture a simplicity or to look for it.
Yeah, and in some ways I think too that there was a kind of a apocalyptic paranoia that the world was going to, if not come to an end, at least that the natural world was going to change inexorably. And that there was a sense that this was one of the last havens you could go to. And to tell you the truth, I think that a lot of that feeling was correct. You know, I've seen the change exist in 20 years.
Yes.
But there was that sense that we'd better do it. And this is one of the few places that we can do it. I mean, to steal a title from a book about Montana, that Alaska was the last best place.
Yes. For people who've tuned in just a moment late, we're talking by phone, and that's the sea noise you're hearing in the background, to author John Hildebrand. He has written a book called Reading the River, A Voyage Down the Yukon. It was published in paper by Houghton Mifflin in 1988, and John's talking to us from his home in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. John, I've mentioned it briefly, but can you set the stage for our listeners for your coming to Alaska and later for writing the book in context of a phrase you used in the book? You said, we came to Alaska for a simpler life, believing if we just lived simply, life itself would be simple.
Yeah, I really believe that, and I think that when I went up to Alaska in 72, I had graduated from college, and I was kind of floundering in terms of work. I was living in San Francisco, and I had a job as day manager in an ice cream parlor a couple blocks from Golden Gate Park. I mean, it was obviously I was not going places in the world, and it seemed this was the right time to live out this particular dream that I had, and that was to build a log cabin, you know, to fashion a home out of the woods, and to somehow live there, live off the land. And so we went, my first wife and I went up to Fairbanks in a VW bus, which seemed to be the mode of travel at the time.
Didn't everybody? That's how I got here, too.
Yeah. and staked 5 acres on Pangani Creek under what was then the state's open entry land program, and managed with some difficulty to build a log cabin. But the thing that we hadn't really considered was the other half of it, which is how do you live off the land? How do you live apart from a town? And that was the part that we had not given any thought to, and it was difficult. I mean, one of the things my wife said that kind of runs as a chorus through the through the first part of the book was there's nothing to do here, and maybe it's just because we didn't know what to do. I think a lot of people with a minimum amount of skills were attracted to this life and then found that they were in some ways not up to it, or it took them a very long time to learn the skills involved. So what happened is I built the cabin, but I ended up living in Fairbanks and going to school and later teaching and living the sort of life maybe that I could have lived anywhere. And when I left Alaska, there was a sense that I had somehow botched my chance, that I had somehow missed the opportunity, that the true north, you know, the north that had existed in my dreams and was kind of fashioned from the books I read, had eluded me. And the notion of going back and traveling down the Yukon River, this was nearly 10 years after I'd left, was in a sense to look for it, to try to recapture that sense of awe about the place, and find out if that mythical true north really existed.
You look
to some extent. It does, and to some extent it doesn't.
You look for it in a fascinating way for the reader, because it seems that you float back and forth in time. The book is always in present tense, but the book goes back 100 years, back 50 years, raises towns where there are now nearly empty villages, raises cities where there are barely towns, and raises a great number of people from past life into a very vivid present.
Yeah, I had thought about in a sense what to write about after the journey. Was I only going to write about my impressions, my recollections? And I wanted a lot more than that. I wanted to include other people's stories, many of whom I found more fascinating than my own. I wanted to also include stories of people who had gone before. And traveling down the river, you're really aware of that sense of the past, because it's there. It hasn't been plowed under. There isn't a new mall where the old cabin used to be. There's the old cabin. And you can't help but wondering about other people's lives and what it was that might have been similar to your own experience and what it was that might have been different? I mean, those are always the two questions I wondered when I came across an old abandoned cabin or an old steamboat that had been hauled up on shore.
There is a... Go ahead.
I'm wondering if this is a good time to read that section.
That we were talking about?
River Time.
Yes, about River Time.
Okay, well, River Time was sort of a concept that seemed to make sense to me and that I tried to employ in the organization of the book, and that was that I could go from one point in time to another, and it seemed justifiable to me. This is a paragraph from a chapter that's called River Time. Wrecked steamboats and old cabins were fragments of a history that wanted to be deciphered. Instead, I let the river carry me downstream. There was no hurry. I was traveling on River Time now. My itinerary was fixed by the river's course, and the current set my timetables. River Time has nothing to do with Greenwich Standard. It is a circular flow, a cross-section of past and present, cutting through time and space, just as the river itself wears down its banks. Drifting down the Yukon, one sees the same river that G.I. Cameron saw on patrol, that all the other river travelers saw. Beyond the next bend, just out of sight, is Schwatka's heaving raft. Around a further bend, a flotilla of Tachone canoes. The changes are infinitesimal against the backdrop of mountains and woods. Alterations tend to be cyclical. The regeneration of forests, the seasonal migration of fish and birds, the extremes of weather. To fix one's place in River Time, everything must be cross-referenced, like counting tree rings or salmon scales. The timelines are horizontal as well as vertical. History, geology, the mythology of the distant time, all of them tributaries flowing together to form this single ongoing river. In that passage, I mentioned a couple of people maybe I should have introduced before.
Sure. Can you introduce us to them now?
Yeah, I could do it. G.I. Cameron was an ex-Mountie. When I met him, he was 83 years old and still quite fit. He lived in Whitehorse. And he had worked as a Mountie in Dawson during the 20s. And in the 30s and 40s, he was the constable in a town called Fort Selkirk, which was later abandoned. And he had told me some wonderful stories about what it was like, essentially, to be the law in this vast territory. Schwatka was Frederick Schwatka, who I didn't meet. He died about 100 years ago, but whose book, Along Alaska's Great River, is something that I used as a reference. And it was interesting to think that I was seeing pretty much the same scenery that Schwatka had. And I also thought about the people who had come before Schwatka, and those were the native Tachone Indians of the Yukon Territory. And it seemed to me that it was a logical thing to do to try to include those different perspectives, those different people, and to see in what ways we concurred on the landscape. And I think in many ways we did.
There is much in this book, it seems to me, of finding a place. And I wondered, as I was reading it, if you weren't finding your place in history relative to others who had come before, as much as you were finding your place on the river and as much as you were finding your place in yourself, since you were also working on untied loose ends in your own life.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that very often that writing is a way of working through a problem. And maybe the problem that I had was I had this great longing for this particular place. And sometimes I found that the place disappointed my expectations of it. And at other times it overwhelmed those expectations. And I was trying to make amends with both. You know, I see that in a lot of books about Alaska. It seems to me that, for example, in John McPhee's book, Coming into the Country, there is a, you know, almost it's the old mythical Alaska again. And in Joe McGinnis's, it's sort of a trashing of the place.
Mm-hmm.
Joe McGinnis's book, Going to Extremes. And it seems to me that you should be able to hold on to both views. There are things that disappoint. There are things that overwhelm. And they all add up to a place. You know? And I try to include both of those things in the book.
John, a good part of this trip was a trip of solitude. It seems to show many colors in the book. You write of comfortable aloneness, floating down the river, and then shifting needs to be with people and to talk and to be silent and to be alone, and then another part of solitude of aching loneliness. These emotions seem to stand out in bas-relief. I'm certain they go on in life regularly for all of us.
Yeah.
But the journey seemed to have set them apart for you.
Well, it was strange. I hadn't really spent much time totally alone. And when I was on the river, I often had the sense that I was passing in and out of zones of noise. So, I mean, I'd run into a group on the river, or maybe I'd stop at a cabin where someone lived. And we talk and talk and talk and talk and talk until I felt talked out. And then I'd drift away, and there'd be absolute silence. There wouldn't be a sound. And it was all kind of a schizophrenic existence to go from one extreme to the other. In some ways, I find traveling alone to be preferable in terms of writing. For one thing, you're on your own, and if the purpose is to write about a place and the people that live there, it's easier to meet people when you're alone. You don't have to filter everything through somebody else. You also have time to kind of talk to yourself, maybe not literally, but I mean to think to yourself about what you're seeing and to mull it over. So aloneness was a big part of the book, and I think getting comfortable with being by yourself. I'd just gone through a divorce, and that was a lesson I needed to learn, how to be comfortable by myself.
There's also some commentary on noise and silence. You talked about ghetto blasters, boomboxes, radios, stereos in villages that, unlike where in cities they were used to create space, ghetto blasters in villages were used to fill in the vast space.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed a perception to me. I think it's valid. That in the city, you see somebody going down the sidewalk and he's got a ghetto blaster or whatever, and in a way, it's a way of making a little territory for yourself, you know, keeping people away. Maybe it's the same reason birds sing. You know, it's defining space. It's filling your environment with your song, no matter how much, you know, it might annoy other people. But what I noticed was that in villages and in fish camps, it really didn't matter where, I'd see the same technology. There'd be this, cassette player blaring out some song, rock and roll, so forth. And it seemed to me here it was, you know, there wasn't anybody to push aside with the noise, but you just filled it up. You filled up the space. And it seemed to me that in Alaska there's an awful lot of space to fill up. Very difficult. But I kind of like boom boxes. I was always interested in what people played. I'd go into a fish camp, and there'd be, you know, I'd go through the cassettes. Wow, what do we got here? Joan Armatrading. That's it. What else do we have? A little Irish music. It was fun.
John, how did you prepare for this trip? I mean, mentally and physically?
Not much. I I'm trying to think of what I did. I bought an airline ticket to Whitehorse, and I brought along a little outboard motor so that this wouldn't be an endurance contest. You know, I paddled the Yukon. You know,
by John Hildebrand.
That wasn't the point of it. You know, I do a lot of canoeing here. I do a lot of whitewater kayaking, but this wasn't going to be that kind of trip. When I was in Whitehorse, I bought a canoe. It was a serviceable canoe, but nothing aesthetically beautiful. I didn't name it or anything. I bought the equipment that I thought I needed, and I had a tent and a sleeping bag. That was about it. I mean, I've done enough camping that it wasn't a big thing to throw together provisions. And I found that in a lot of villages there'd be a store, and I could pick up pilot bread and peanut butter, which was my main staple.
Mm-hmm. And maps? Did you bring a great number
and
of maps?
I sent away to the USGS and also to Canadian equivalent for maps. It's not as if you're really going to get lost. I mean, there's one river, and you stay with the current, and you'll make it all right. But I like to know where I am, and I like that sense of looking at a map and locating yourself. I mean, I find that very comforting to find myself on a map. I also like the place names.
Was there mental preparation? I wonder if you were sitting at home one day and said, now is the time to do it, and bought the ticket.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, I'd just gone through a divorce, and in a sense, I didn't have too many obligations. I had a little bit of money from the sale of the home. Nobody was going to miss me terribly, so it was the right time. It's funny, when I got to Whitehorse, you know, there's always a period, and I always feel this before going off on a trip, of nervousness. You know, it took me several days to leave Whitehorse. And once I got on the boat and started off, it was fine. But it's just that wondering, what's it going to be like? And turned out it was fine.
There are both animals and themes who stay through the pages of this book and with you. The salmon is a major theme. I'm not sure if that's the right word with the book. Can you talk about your attraction to and fascination with the salmon?
Well, it was the one creature that I kept running into. The salmon is really the life of the river. I think most of the villages historically were located on the river, not only for transportation, but also because this is where the salmon were. And the salmon are still important. You know, when I would stop at a cabin, usually it was a fish camp. People were there to catch the fish. This would be not only Athabaskan and Yupik Eskimo fish camps, but also white subsistence people. And they were there to catch the fish and to dry them. And I stopped and spent some time with some Canadian fishery biologists who were live trapping salmon. These were migrating king salmon, live trapping them in fish wheels, and then implanting radio transmitters so that they could follow the migrations of the fish. A salmon is a creature that's very easy to be in awe of, particularly when you see that it's completed a journey upriver of nearly 2,000 miles, and the way that they navigate, and the fact that their purpose for this immense trip is to spawn and then to die, and the way they do it. There's a there's one little scene, I guess, one little paragraph I'd like to read from the time that I spent with the salmon biologist. We had just pulled a salmon out of a king salmon out of a live box, and this is the chief biologist talk. "You want to get them back into the river as quickly as possible," the chief biologist said. "Salmon have a biological imperative and a set amount of energy. If you delay them too long, you reduce their chances of spawning successfully. The last thing any of us wanted to do was hold up a salmon's journey. There was a keen sense of urgency, a seriousness in the endeavor, because propagation of the species, not their own survival, propelled the salmon upriver. Still, it was the individual fish that you rooted for. Even if salmon have no choice in their movement, the effort seems heroic. The poignancy of the migration was not that it ended with mating and death, but the salmon were so eager to get on with both." And I kept running into salmon as I went down the river. One of the most moving sights that I saw was in Caltag, on the Caltag River, where I came across a spawning run of chum salmon. And you see the mating salmon and the dying salmon side by side. I mean, it's sort of like life speeded up, down to its essentials. And you can't help but being moved in by it.
In another way, bears seem to loom large for you as well. Early in the book, you talk about bears with a kind of self-mocking bravado. And then later, they're connected with what I could only think of as an icy fear that you said at one point that you called it the old fear, the fear of death by being consumed by an animal, and that animal was clearly a bear.
Yeah, and it runs through the book. My old fear, and I want to try to keep separate this fear from the animal itself. You know, my encounters with bears, what encounters they are, have always been kind of anticlimactic. I mean, one time I was hunting north of my cabin, and I came across a steaming mound of bear dung, and just started taking off from it, and I ran into a place where a bear had been digging, and I didn't see the bear, but I heard this grunt, and it struck me not that this was a vicious animal intent on, you know, filleting me and having me for dinner, but that how polite of an animal to announce its presence, or like somebody coming into a room. Here I am. Watch out. But what I was thinking about mostly is just the fear. And I think this is the fear that propels all the bear stories. The first time I came to Alaska, I'm going off to camp and to build a cabin. People say, wait a minute, did you hear this story about the guy, the bear pulled his head off? All they found were the bones, all these grotesque stories. And people love to tell them. Especially if they know you're heading off into the woods. But I think what the bear story is in a sense, it's a reminder of mortality. It's a reminder of just the fear of death. And that's why I call it the old fear. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing a little reading by Joseph Campbell, a book called The Way of Animal, The Way of Animal Spirits, or something like that. And he talks about bear ceremonialism, not only among tribal people in North America, but really throughout the world, wherever there are bears. And he goes back to the drawings in the Paleolithic, I guess that would be it, caves in Europe. And the bear, this would be the cave bear, was the animal master. I mean, it is an animal that I think people in all cultures through history have been kind of awed at, because not only is it so powerful, but it resembles ourselves. You know, a skin bear looks like nothing more than a human corpse. And I think that a lot of the, for example, Athabascan taboos and bear ceremonialism recognize this, you know, recognizes this sense of fear and respect. I mean, it's almost kind of an Old Testament fear and awe about this animal. And it's, in some respects, quite apart from the animal itself. It's our reflection of this thing.
It seems you found in your reality on the river less to fear than to be challenged by. At least that's my read of it. The wilderness for you was not fearsome, with exception of the beers.
What did you say? The wilderness was not?
Was not fearsome, with exception of the bears.
No, it wasn't. I think the wilderness always looks fearsome from a distance. You know, it's like a dark room. Once you get used to the dark, once you get comfortable, it's not a problem. There wasn't much to be afraid of. I think the most powerful thing there was the river itself. And it was hard to remind myself that I had to be careful. But people occasionally would remind me. They would say about people who drowned, people who are good swimmers. And they'd just say, well, the river took them. The river just took them. And I thought, well, what do you mean? I've been on this river for nearly 2 months now, and it's been fine to me. And I didn't run into any trouble. I went through Five Finger Rapids without any problem. I didn't run into any trouble until near the end of the trip, and that was down the lower Yukon near Pilot Station. And I just ran into enormous swells. And the river got wider and wider, and the southern boundary of the river is all tundra. You're kind of circumscribing the Yukon Delta at that point, and you get these winds that come off the Bering Sea. And whenever they run counter to the current, these enormous ocean-like swells develop. And I got into them in my little 15-foot open canoe, and I thought I'd bought the farm. I thought it's all over for me. And I've been in whitewater before. I'm not unused to waves. But that's the most scared I've ever been, the most certain I was going to drown.
John, why don't you turn to that passage? It begins on 218.
Okay.
At the second to the last paragraph. It says it so well. I'd like to give you a chance to say it from the book itself.
Well, that's one of the reasons that you write these things, because it's so difficult to say it extemporaneously. Okay. This is above Pilot Station. The Yukon formed a T as it bent sharply to the southwest, and the Chunak River entered from the east. Racing around the bend, I saw the blue-roofed houses of Pilot Station in a saddle between two hills. The village could not have been more than a mile away, so I steered a direct course for it, cutting diagonally across the river. Then everything went wrong. A blast of wind caught me as I cleared the bend. Funneled down the narrow flume of the channel, the wind curled the river back on itself. Billowy waves loomed ahead like a range of green hills dusted with snow. Too late, I remembered Leslie Hunter's warning about the final bad stretch of river. It was here. If I headed straight for shore, the waves would smash the canoe broadside and capsize it, so I had no choice but to steer straight into the green wall of water. The first swell lifted the bow into the air, the horizon tilted, and the canoe slid down the long valley of the wave. Climbing the next crest, I tried to count the oncoming rollers, wondering how they would break, trying to read the one that would finally crash over the bow and swamp the boat. The sensation was of being propelled forward by a mob, a noise roaring in my ears, unable to stop or turn, but only keep pace and stay alert. The shore lay a quarter mile swim in either direction. But it might as well have been half an ocean away. If I capsized, silt would have filled my pockets and boots, and I would have done the Australian crawl in slow motion to the bottom. Seagulls careened overhead. safe on two counts, the gulls pivoted their small white heads to see if any fish were in the boat, if perhaps I was a fish. At first I felt a perverse thrill as the canoe smacked into a wave and still emerged upright. But knowing that I was almost certainly going to drown soon filled me with rage. At the fishermen for not warning me, at the river for letting me come this far only to drown in plain sight of blue-roofed houses, but mostly at myself for being so careless, so stupid, as to ruin a perfectly good life by throwing it away. Shouting into the wind, I prayed the most basic prayer. Save me. Spare my life. A roller swept the canoe up, then slammed it down into the hollow so hard that the gas tank nearly jumped into my lap. Between one terrible crest and the onslaught of another, I began veering ever so slightly toward the right bank, then straightening the bow before the roller hit. Slowly I edged further from the foamy peaks until the canoe slipped into the sidewash. Then suddenly I was out of it, in calm water, the village shining ahead. And I'll never forget that.
There's a section just to follow that I enjoyed immensely. You say, on wobbly legs, I walked up the beach past the Russian church and up a hill to the little post office to mail the letter I had written the night before. The mail plane had just arrived, and I had to wait in line while the mail was sorted. But it was a pleasant wait. People joked about the delay and enjoyed the sunshine. Standing there among strangers, I found myself smiling too and thought, how amazing all of this is, simply being alive. I was elated because my life had been handed back to me when it seemed almost certainly lost. I felt the wind in the hair and noticed that my red baseball cap was gone. I suppose it made me laugh because I don't know. Well, I'll say this differently. I know a good many people who have had those experiences, whether it is driving or canoeing or hiking a mountain, or all of a sudden your life is the most tenuous thing you've ever seen. It's a broken limb, leaf in the wind. And when you manage to get through it, everything is wonderful. The people standing next to you, the
right.
Sun in the sky, the fact that the rain is falling. It's just an amazing elation.
Well, I think maybe that's why people climb mountains. I don't know. But I also wonder if it accounts for a lot of the just pure joy that you sense in traditional Eskimo songs and poetry. I mean, here has got to be one of the hardest lives imaginable. And yet, when you read Eskimo songs, they're just so full of that, so full of that joy. There's the poem that I took as an epigram for the beginning of the book, and maybe this is a good time to read it.
I was just going to ask.
I think I was feeling exactly the same thing as in this song. It's a Eskimo song translated by Knut Rasmussen in this book, Intellectual Culture of the Copper Eskimos. And probably people are familiar with this song. And I think over again, my small adventures, when with a shore wind I drifted out in my kayak and thought I was in danger, my fears, those small ones that I thought so big, for all the vital things I had to get and to reach. And yet, there is only one great thing, the only thing, to live to see in huts and on journeys the great day that dawns and the light that fills the world. And when I took the trip, I had that scotch tape to one of my notebooks, uh-huh. just to remind myself of it. And that's exactly how I felt after the rough water. I just thought about the joy and the light that fills the world, and I was glad to be on dry land.
We're talking to John Hildebrand. He's the author of Reading the River, A Voyage Down the Yukon, about his 2-plus-month trip down the Yukon River from Whitehorse to St. Mary's, accomplished in 1983 and published in paperback by Houghton Mifflin in 1988. John, there are a couple of striking stories in the book about tremendous courage in the face of tremendous odds and of both wanderlust and a willingness to begin life all over again in any place you find yourself. Frank Yasuda's story, the Japanese man who seemed to have covered the world in his life, who ended up in Point Barrow and then led a settlement trip to Beaver. Can you tell a bit of this story? I just found it. I found him rather awesome, actually.
It's a fascinating story. When I reached Beaver, I came into the landing, which is sort of a depression where boats can get in, and there was a native fellow there cooking a dog pot for his dog team, and he helped me pull the boat ashore. And I thought, gee, this guy looks awfully Eskimo to be in the middle of Athabascan Indian territory. And I asked him about it. I said, oh, yeah, most of the people from Beaver are Eskimos. We came down around the turn of the century from Point Barrow. I thought, well, that's incredible. And the more I looked into it, the more incredible the story got, because the kind of the instigator for this enormous migration was a Japanese man named Frank Yasuda, who had been a ship steward on the revenue cutter Bear, and had made several journeys on the Bear from San Francisco up through the Arctic Ocean. And one time he decided to stay in Point Barrow and to trade. He married an Eskimo woman and decided, hit upon the idea of not only looking for gold, but also that it would be a good idea to supply the mining camps in the Brooks Range with fresh meat. So he led a number of Eskimo families into the Brooks Range. And eventually they came to the Yukon River, and he asked one of the older Eskimos to pick a spot, a good spot for a village. And the man looked over the trees and looked over the ground and said, this is it. And that's what became Beaver. It's a very beautiful spot in the Yukon Flats. And it's really a mix of people. I mean, they're Athabascan and Inupiaq Eskimo and so forth. And Frank Yasuda was regarded as, even in the 1920s, as a pioneer Alaska and something of a hero, tough and self-reliant, independent, all the values that Alaskans admire. And he was really the founder of this place. Then in 1941, his daughter Hannah heard on the radio that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor, and she ran to tell her father, and he said, no, it can't be true. This is the incredible part of the story. He was interned in a internment, which is a nice way of saying concentration camp, in New Mexico at the age of 74. Here's a man who had, you know, founded a village in Alaska and a pioneer, and he was shipped out. And the incredible thing is that he survived that. He survived 3 years in the internment camp, and he came back, and he wasn't bitter. They asked him what it was like, and he said, well, he said it was amazing. There were so many Japanese people. He hadn't seen so many Japanese faces since he had been a small boy living in Japan. And one of the things that struck me about this story, and about really so many of the people I met, particularly the older people, was some of the hardships they faced, the difficulties, and yet the absolute lack of rancor, bitterness. And I think for me, and maybe for other people in my generation, as we get older, this is the big question. Well, how are we going to grow old? What kind of people are we going to be like? And I think we need those heroes. I think we need those people to show us how to do it and how to do it with some grace. And for me, there were a lot of people in the book who did that.
And this is something for which you were, I don't know whether it was actively searching, but it was certainly a part of this voyage, was it not? To look into other people's lives, you mentioned, to see how they live so that I might learn?
Yeah, it's very much that way. I mean, there were a couple of groups that I was interested in. And as I say, this wasn't just the book really isn't just about a wilderness river, because I was interested in the river, certainly, but also about the people who lived on it. And there were maybe three groups. And one was the people my age who had come up to Alaska in the early 70s, part of that strange migration. Only the people who had stuck it out, you know, who had gone up to the Yukon in the mid-70s and were still there 10 years later, still working at it. I was curious about them. They were sort of the people that I might have been, and I wanted to see how their lives turned out. And another group were some of the former students that I had. I taught primarily Eskimo and Indian students at the university in Fairbanks, and they were from places like Nulato and Tanana and Koyukuk and Holy Cross. And they would write these essays about life back home, and they were fascinating to me. And I thought, well, gee, what would it be like to see them? And I did run into a couple of old students, which was great. And finally, there were the older people, the people who had kind of sunk their roots in here, both native and white, and also like G.I. Cameron, the old Mountie that I met in Whitehorse, or Ida Golter, who was in Carmack, or the Sister Scholastica, who died a couple years ago, but who was in Holy Cross. Not that he's old, but also Claude Dementis, who runs the Dementis Barge Service, was somebody who just impressed me very much with their capability, and also I guess they're just their charm and their grace going through doing what they do.
The title of your book is Reading the River, and it seems to me that Claude Dementis is a man who reads rivers, especially the Yukon River, very, very well.
He as I say, is one of the heroes of the book, because he was kind of the penultimate river man. I grew up on the river and makes his living on the river. And one of the pleasures for me was hitching a ride on his barge, the Ramona, from Tanana to just below Koyukuk, about 150 miles. I'll just read a little section of that. Standing behind Claude, I tried to imagine the Yukon as he saw it. In the long daylight hours of summer, a novice might steer a ship like the Ramona down the Yukon by reading its surface. But in the lengthening evenings of late summer and fall, a pilot had to know the river by heart, because, except for hairpin turns, Yukon is unmarked. Some riverboat pilots keep elaborate navigation charts of shoals and reefs, revised each year as the river rewrites itself. Claude, however, worked without maps. He knew the river's contours by memory and could fix his position in the dark by the silhouette of hills. The challenge of running a ship in autumn is knowing when to quit. Slush ice starts running on the Yukon in early October, stopping for a brief respite as tributaries freeze over before ice seals the main river shut. But if a customer needed supplies, and this was typical, Claude would press his luck with a last trip, heading back to home port Nenana with ice closing in behind him. The greatest danger is that the engine would fail and the boat ground on a sandbar, swamping as the pressure of the ice inexorably builds. One year, Claude said, we couldn't make it back to Nenana. The ice was running so badly we had to park the tug and barge in a slough at the mouth of the Nowitna. Then we took the pilot boat to Ruby, got a loaf of bread and a quart of whiskey and drifted all night to Galena. We flew back in late April and landed on the ice. Oh, we had a great time living on the boat. For a month we hunted ducks and set nets for whitefish and waited for the river to clear. Because he was hard of hearing, Claude sometimes guessed what my questions had been, a tactic I'm familiar with, being partially deaf myself. Finally, I gave up asking questions. Just watching the river unfold over his shoulder was a singular pleasure. If you asked villagers along the Yukon who was the best riverman, the answer was always Claude Demento. Like the musher George Atla, another local hero, he was admired not just for being expert at what he did, but for not changing in the process. Claude had grown up on the river, and for him, every stretch was a kind of homecoming. And when we, that's the end of that section, but when we would land at a place to unload freight, I mean, I had the sense that I was traveling with a kind of revered politician making the rounds. Mm-hmm. And people would come down to the landing to watch the show, so to speak, and Claude, who owns the barge, also does all the work, along with the deckhands. I mean, he's up there with a, I don't know, if I forget the name of the, with a backloader, and he's unloading all the stuff. He's the guy who gets the gang planks out. He's the one who has the longest watches. You know, he'll sometimes go 2 days without sleeping. And yet he's always there joking with the people at the landing and pumping hands and saying, well, how are you doing, and so forth. It was a nice way to travel, to travel in his entourage, as it were.
Sounds like in his arms, since the whole world of his boat and the river through which it passes is under his control and eyes. You mentioned at one point you were sitting in the galley having dinner, and Claude was deep in conversation, but with one eye out the porthole, and he became slightly distracted and put his spoon down, got up, and went up to the wheelhouse, and evidently the man who was at the wheel was too close to shore. So he's on duty 24 hours a day, this gentleman.
Yeah, and I mean, he just sort of glanced out the porthole, and without a word, whoop, he was up in the pilot house. I mean, he knew exactly where the boat should have been. And that's what I think of as sort of being an expert river person. And one other thing I might mention is it's the barges, I think, that have kept the villages going, whereas in the Yukon Territory, there are all these abandoned villages. And when the steamboats stopped running, the government moved the people off the river and to sites along the highway. And I, you know, the Yukon running through Canada is a very beautiful river, but in some ways it's sort of like a museum piece. And it was more exciting to get onto the American side of the river, where, you know, the villages were still alive and vital, and the river was much more a working river.
While you were reading and talking about Claude Demento, I was thinking how much river time must figure in his life. The winter closes in, the barge is shut away, and we wait until April.
Yeah.
And also at the end of that passage, you write, this might have been the Mississippi River 200, 300 years ago. In the vast, unlit expanse, there was nothing to suggest that the landscape was not untouched and primeval. The age of steamboats came and went, the boom towns fading into the woods. Time seemed to flow backward, and I could imagine hunters huddled over campfires on their long trek inland, their heads bent to the sound of beasts trampling through the darkness. Suggests to me that there is another river time, which is a river time that is ignorant of humankind, indifferent, and that long after we are here, whether our governments impose restrictions on how we may or may not use the land or not, with any luck, the land will still be there. in its river time.
Yeah, this is one of the more humbling aspects of, I think, traveling down the river. So often, I think we assume that the things we build will last forever. Traveling down the river, you see that they don't. The river just carves them away, and it carves away a lot of the land. And it's interesting to note that there were a lot of settlements on the river that have just plain disappeared over the time. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to older people from another generation, is to realize that ours wasn't the only one who had this impulse to try on the north. People have been doing this for a long, long time, and they come and they go, and what remains is the river and the land, and you really get that sense traveling down the river.
John, by the time you finished your trip, you had resolved, I think, certain rifts in your own mind. You turned one day in the rain to a pad and paper and wrote to your much estranged ex-wife as much, you said, to say goodbye as to say hello, and to say hello as to say goodbye. It felt like pieces from your life through this journey on the river began to come together. Is there a pulling together of thoughts given these 2 months that you were on the Yukon?
Yeah, I again it was, I didn't mean to suggest a resolution that wasn't there. I mean, it was literally true. At the end of the journey, things had somehow sorted itself out. In a number of different respects. I mean, when I wrote to my ex-wife, it was really for the first time without rancor. I don't know, maybe time and distance sort things out, and you can see things more clearly. And instead of concentrating on things we disagreed with, I tried to understand her perspective. I also had to come to grips with my feelings about Alaska. I mean, it was a place that I had loved a great deal and had yet felt estranged from, having left it. And the trip was a way of kind of reconciling myself to the place. I don't feel like I have to build a cabin and live there anymore to have that connection anymore. For me, the trip did it. The trip was a way of sorting out my feelings about that particular place. And I feel like Alaska and I are on speaking terms again. That we're okay. That we have joint custody, so to speak.
You bring this to a fine point, I think, at the end of the book when you answer what you say is your ex-wife's question, but I can hear you also saying it is yours, when she said, "But there's nothing to do here," and you go on from there to say what you have found in response to that statement.
Yeah, this is the end of the book, and I'm back in the cabin that I built. I've sort of come full circle. The rain kept me stuck here, just as it kept me from reaching the sea. In the steady drumming, I heard the sad echo of my ex-wife's voice. "But there's nothing to do here." I had never come up with an answer for that. On the Yukon, what had amazed me most was how people faced a landscape that was so utterly indifferent to them, without bitterness, and even with a lightness and gaiety about them, realizing that there was, finally, nothing to be done. Snuffing out the kerosene lamp, I curled in my sleeping bag close to the stove, alternately roasting and shivering. The night was filled with starts, awakenings in the dark, screeching of owls and imagined bears stalking close by in the woods. Morning broke cool, the cabin floor sharply lit with sunlight. The rain had stopped, and in its place, awakened flies buzzed against the window panes. Stiffly, I dressed and began the fire in the stove, placing water on top for coffee. Blueberry pancakes were the order for breakfast. I walked slowly toward the creek, gathering up ripe berries in a tin plate. The day was heartbreakingly beautiful. Blue-washed sky, raindrops glistening on the willows, the creek running fast and full. The outer range was plainly visible, talus slopes dusted with the first fine snow of the coming winter. Now the warm sunlight, the snow was melting. The runoff coursing down the green mountain slopes into the watershed that feeds the Nenana and the Tanana and the Yukon and flows finally into an ocean that covers the world.
John Hildebrand reading from his book, Reading the River, A Voyage Down the Yukon. Thank you, John, for spending the last hour with us on KUAC-FM. To let people know that John's book, Reading the River, is published in paperback as of 1988 by Houghton Mifflin. John Hildebrand, a former student and later instructor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, is now an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and the sound of the sea in the background is because we've been talking to John from his home in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Thanks again, John.
See, Nancy, when will this air?
I got it. August 6th. I'm sorry. I had to roll ahead.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because I might call up my friends and tell them.
Well, good. Sure. Tell them it'll be on KUAC Sunday at noon. August 6th. Right.
Okay. Well, it's certainly been fun talking to you.
Thanks.
This has been the most painless interview I've had.
Well, good. We try to specialize in painless interviews around here, but very enjoyable for me, too. And, John, it's a fine book. I enjoyed reading it immensely.
Well, it's nice to hear. Very often, the interviewer has not read the book, and I have to fill in everything.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
Yeah.
Write another one. I'll read that, too.
Okay. Well, thanks again, and thanks for getting up so early.
My pleasure. Take good care.
All righty.
Bye-bye. I'm Susan McInnes. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again next week on Sunday at noon.